I was smiling a little bit during the meditation. But first of all, I apologize. Something happened with my connection just as when I was talking about impermanence. I don't know where it cut off, but I was just off the call, and it just said connecting, connecting, and I got one of those little things. So I was surprised because when I first connected, I was using the cord, the Ethernet. And now I'm on Wi-Fi, so I hopefully it will be stable, but if I disappear, don't worry. And so that was one thing that I smiled about during the meditation. And then the other thing was remembering a friend of mine who is a Dharma teacher, telling me the story of that there's a group that he regularly, but somewhat occasionally, teaches at. And he lives in Berkeley, and I think the group is, I don't know if it's in Davis. It's a little bit of a drive, but and maybe he goes there 4 times a year. And so he really likes the group, and he feels very comfortable with the group, and he always enjoys it. And I was just saying, oh, that's kind of, that's how I feel about this group. This is so enjoyable for me, and I feel so comfortable. It's just a pleasure to be with you. And then he was telling me that he went to go talk to this group, sitting group, and he gave his talk, and then he got home, and I guess he has a system of logging his talks. It's way more organized than I am, but he kind of writes down like the kind of topic that he talked about something, and he realized that he gave the exact same talk to that group the last time he was there. But he said nobody said anything. They were all very politely listened, and he does, I think, work from pretty detailed notes. So his talks really are kind of like, if he's giving it, it's probably pretty similar. Anyway, so I was just smiling about that and thinking, I wonder if I've talked about this before. Probably like, well, you talk about that every time.
We won't be so polite. We'll let them
Don't be polite. Don't just, yeah. But it's interesting with Dharma that sometimes I'll listen to, if there's a talk I particularly liked, I'm sure you've had this experience of you might listen to it again, or you might reread something, a chapter in a book, and it's like, oh, I missed there, this is there's so much in it. Not that there's so much new, but I think there's something about a talk that it's really co-created. Maybe half of it are the words I say, but at least half of it is what you hear and what, what we take in and what we, I don't know if it's what we're ready to hear or what's helpful for us to hear. So in any case, I hope something is helpful, even if you've heard it before. Well, there's a poem I wanted to share, but before I talk about that, I wanted to start with this story that is kind of a famous Zen story or Zen koan. That there was a teacher who, I think he was called Master Ma in the Chinese Chan tradition, who was known for being a very fierce, physically strong teacher. And then at some point near the end of his life, he became sick, and he was quite ill. And his student, his attendant, his close disciple, asked him, "How are you feeling today, Master?" And Master Ma's answer became this sort of koan or sort of famous teaching story. And the master answered, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha." That was his response. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. And I've always liked this story, and one of the pieces of background that I didn't know until I had studied it a little bit was that I think in the Chinese tradition, the sun-faced Buddha is the, you know, there's a, in the Mahayana, there's many Buddhas, right? And many different, archetypes of what a Buddha is. The sun-faced Buddha is a Buddha who lives for 1,800 years. So it's a really long-lived Buddha. And the moon-faced Buddha is a Buddha who lives for just one day and one night. So sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. So very different circumstances, very different conditions. Just the way maybe each of us, you know, different lives, different conditions. Every person, every being has its own destiny, its own lifespan, its own expression. But even though these are so different, almost like opposites, the sun and the moon, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, they're both Buddhas, right? They're both Buddhas. They're both complete. They're both awake. They're both perfectly what they are. And so there's something for me that's very inspiring about this, that, for someone who's sick, you know, maybe, I don't know, but maybe this Master Ma was dying or was very sick. And to give this answer, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, healthy Buddha, sick Buddha, happy Buddha, sad Buddha, strong Buddha, weak Buddha. There's something for me that's very refreshing about this perspective, very liberating about this perspective, that rather than thinking of Buddha as something, some ideal of perfection that, you know, we'll never get there, just keep trying, you know, that kind of, you know, it's out there, we're here and that's there. This is pointing to something that's much closer, that Buddha maybe is the perfection of each moment as it is. You know, when we don't cling, when we don't resist, when we don't turn away, when we don't grasp, that's an opportunity to recognize Buddha. So if we have this perspective, that Buddha is each state, each moment, each experience in this changing existence, that in some way is totally itself, has its own purity, then we can say that there's happy Buddha, there's sad Buddha, There's wobbly Buddha. There's perfectly still Buddha. And maybe to see others as Buddha is to appreciate who they are, you know, without comparing. I mean, of course we do this all the time. We're always in comparing mind, comparing mode. But when we can, for a moment, let go of that, we can appreciate each other, appreciate another for who they are. You know, to see the Buddha in each person. So I think about this story, and I just think there's a way that it it opens another perspective. You know, it's the perspective of that we don't have to change ourselves so much. You know, practice is not about changing ourselves and going from what we're not, you know, going from here to there. But in a powerful way, it's maybe about recognizing what's already here. You know, what supports that? What supports that recognition? So that's the story of Sun-Faced Buddha and Moon-Faced Buddha. And in my mind, one of the reasons that I thought about talking about this was last night I happened to watch the film from, I guess it was made, didn't seem that long ago, but it was made in 1990, called Awakenings. I don't know if anyone has seen that film. This is a film that was with Robin Williams, a great cast, Robin Williams, and I think it's Robert De Niro. And it's based on the true story by the neurologist Oliver Sacks. And Oliver Sacks was a very famous neurologist and a wonderful writer. So he wrote like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and all these different, I actually haven't read, the only book I'm listening to by Oliver Sacks is his memoir. It was the first one I'm listening to, which is wonderful, which is called My Own Life. And it's available on the, you know, you can get it on the audiobook. But I guess Oliver Sacks was a neurologist who worked at a public long-term hospital in the late 1960s. And he just recently passed away in his 80s. So this, I think, was in the 60s and the 70s that he was working in the Bronx. And there were a number of patients in this long-term facility who were basically catatonic. They were sort of frozen and they couldn't speak and they had a lot of trouble moving and they weren't really, you know, they weren't exactly neglected, but they weren't a top priority to figure out, you know, how to help them or how to, it could kind of just like, you know, just tolerated is not exactly the word I'm trying to come up with, but they were taken care of, but there wasn't much interest in them. And then this doctor came onto the ward and he became very interested and he started to realize that these people were actually more awake and more alert than they seemed. And there was a way that they were kind of locked in. And so he started to study their files and realized that they had something in common with each other. And through his own awareness and curiosity and love and care, he started working with them and thinking about them. And he eventually realized that there was one medication which happened to be new at the time, which was L-DOPA, which is a drug that's, you know, famous now for supporting Parkinson's. I think it helps in Parkinson's. It's not a cure, of course, but I think it helps. And he gave these catatonic patients who didn't have Parkinson's, but there was something a little bit similar. He gave them this medicine and they came to life. They woke up. And it was so moving to see that from his love, from his care, his interest, that he facilitated this kind of awakening. And then Robert De Niro is like the first patient who got the medicine, and you kind of see his little bit of his journey. And so sadly, the medication, which I think is sort of the nature of L-DOPA, it wears off, or it becomes less effective over time. So I think most of the patients sort of eventually return to like this sort of locked in state. But to see the joy that they had when they woke up, and the way they appreciated life, the wonder, the beauty. So they danced and they sang and they laughed, and there was also sadness. You know, one of the patients said, "I feel swindled because, you know, I've been basically asleep for 30 years and my whole, you know, life has gone by." But Robert De Niro's character, he, you know, I don't know how much of this is, you know, film sort of liberties that they take with the film or how much of this is true, but Robert De Niro's character, who's the patient, became very close with the doctor. And he was saying to the doctor, "You need to live your life and enjoy yourself." And the doctor was very kind of, you know, not social and not sort of afraid of people in a way. And so the doctor helped the patients to wake up. And then the patient helped the doctor to wake up. And through seeing how they could experience their life in a new, fresh way, that awoke something in the doctor. I recommend the film, and it was very, very sweet. But I think there's a way that in our practice, it can help us to experience our life with fresh eyes, you know? And I think in Zen, this is called the beginner's mind, you know, that usually we have such thick layers of filters of story and concepts and opinions and comparisons. And we don't appreciate everything we have, and to be grateful for what we have. Until, of course, we don't have it anymore. And then we think, "Oh, I should have appreciated that more." So I came across a quote, and this is a quote from Norman Fisher. Some of you might know Norman, who's a longtime Zen teacher. He was the abbot of Zen Center, I think in the 90s. And so he was talking about emptiness and compassion, which are, you know, even for us here in the Vipassana world, those are pretty, you know, pretty important aspects of practice, emptiness and compassion. And the way what he talked about them, he calls them wonder and warmth. Wonder and warmth. And that was so lovely for me, because it was like the words emptiness and compassion, I mean, they're powerful words, but they're a little abstract. And I, you know, it doesn't necessarily evoke something in me, but to experience wonder and to experience warmth. Oh, okay. And what he says is that these are the pillars of practice. You know, so what does he say here? I hope I have it. Oh, here. Love is generated by twin impulses. Buddhism calls them emptiness and compassion. We could also call them wonder and warmth. Emptiness points to the miraculous nature of phenomena, that things are not what they appear to be, that they are, rather than separate, connected, rather than fixed and weighted, that they're fluid and light. When we see a baby, when we look at the face of our beloved, we know that the way we've been conditioned to perceive the world isn't right. The world is not a fearful and problematic challenge. It is instead a beautiful gift, and we are always at the center. I said, "Oh, how wonderful that, you know, that there's something essential, there's something, you know, the essence of this practice, the essence of awakening is returning to this wonder, returning to this warmth. And for me, in some way, that's connected to this idea that each moment is valuable. Each moment is its own expression of the Dharma that can't be compared. Each moment has its own purity. And so when we open to sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, happy Buddha, angry Buddha, fearful Buddha, it's not a neutral affect. It's actually that opens us to wonder, that opens us to joy, that opens us to warmth, even when the contents of the moment are difficult. And it's this amazing paradox that something can be difficult and in another way, joyful. So that idea of the wonder of each moment, the miracle of each moment, reminded me of a poem. So maybe I'll just share the poem and then it'll kind of be a good place to land. This is a translation of a poem by Hafiz called Deepening the Wonder. He says, "Death is a favor to us, but our scales have lost their balance. The impermanence of the body should give us great clarity, deepening the wonder in our senses and eyes of this mysterious existence we share and are surely just traveling through. If I were in the tavern tonight, I would buy freely for everyone in this world, because our marriage with the cruel beauty of time and space cannot endure very long. Death is a favor to us, but our minds have lost their balance. The miraculous existence and impermanence of form always makes the awakened ones laugh and sing." Deepening the wonder. And this paradox of practice that maybe the more we open to the truth of impermanence, the more we open to the flow of everything, because the miraculous existence and impermanence of form, it's not a neutral experience. It always makes the awakened ones laugh and sing. And I find that very comforting, that the more we open to what's true, the more we contact what's true, this is an experience of wonder and warmth. This is an experience of emptiness and compassion, that's joyful. The great Zen master Dogen called it the Dharma gate of joy and ease. I think when we think about impermanence, that can bring up our fears, that can bring up our, we don't want to lose what we have, what we think we have. But that's why I appreciate that it's about this direct experience, little by little, letting ourselves directly experience this flow of change. And the wonder and the warmth that could come from that. So maybe when we have a difficult moment, when we're sick or struggling in some way, we can say, this too is Buddha. You know, this is not a mistake. This is not something that I, some great failure of mine. This is just the way things are. Maybe in any moment of our life or a moment of meditation, we can just reflect and ask, what kind of Buddha is here right now? What kind of Buddha am I right now? What kind of Buddha are you? So, yeah, thank you very much. I feel nice to sit with you and be with you. And I'm curious, maybe there's a little time, if, you know, thoughts you have about this, questions, comments.
Yeah. Max, this is Daryl, as always. Thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us. We always appreciate your message, and certainly this time as well. Thanks for helping us put things in perspective.
Max, how far would you take the parallel between the feeling of wonder and the feeling of emptiness?
Well, you know, what I like about it is that it's a reminder for me that So what I would say is emptiness itself is not a feeling state, right? You know, emptiness is kind of just the way things are. You know, the one sort of imperfect synonym for emptiness is impermanence. You know, because of impermanence, things are empty. So in the same way, impermanence is not a, it's not a feeling state. It's not the same thing as wonder. But it's a little bit of a good barometer or good check. So if I think I'm opening to emptiness, if I think I'm opening to really contacting impermanence, and I'm not feeling that wonder, you know, it's a little pointer for myself. Check it out. You know, what's going on here? And is there, and usually, I think for most of us, there's some wisdom mixed with some delusion. You know, so we're in and out. We're there, we're contacting impermanence, we're seeing the way things change, and maybe we don't like it. Or maybe we're, you know, something's coming up and there's some grasping, there's some clinging, there's some fear. And that's what blocks the wonder, is the clinging, is the grasping. So for me, it's sort of like the, when we're fully open to change, to impermanence, to emptiness, and we're not resisting, we're kind of, you know, and I think we all know, not necessarily in meditation, but just in life, what that, you know, what that can feel like. The feeling of that is wonder. Maybe, you know, so it's an invitation, and it's not, you know, it rings true for me, and that's something about the perception of you know, I mean, even in the Pali text, they talk about all conditioned things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away. To open to this fully, to come to peace with this truth is the greatest happiness. You know, it doesn't say to come to peace with this truth is sort of so-so and, you know, whatever. You know, it's like, that's a pretty big statement to say it's the highest happiness. It's the greatest happiness. So there's something about aligning ourselves with this truth of impermanence or this truth of emptiness that releases something in us, that frees something. So it's a pretty radical thing. So wonder in a way is almost like a kind of a, you know, I don't know, it's a modest word compared to what the Buddha said, you know, it's the greatest happiness that a person can experience. So that's sort of how I understand it. And it's just, it sort of helps me to, if there isn't a sense of freedom, if there isn't a sense of wonder, you know, with no judgment, but just to look carefully, you know, what's there, and usually it's, yeah, there's some clinging.
Hey, Max, thanks a lot. Really appreciate the talk. Sorry, Margaret, did you have some? I really appreciate the talk. And I guess I was also wondering about where joy and ease versus wonder and warmth and emptiness and compassion all fit together. Because joy and ease and wonder and warmth all sound easier to me than emptiness. And I'm all about the, I mean, I certainly want the easy path to enlightenment.
Yeah. No, you know, it's often said that it's easy to miss the connection between emptiness and compassion. Sometimes they're talked about that. You know, it feels like emptiness is the real wisdom, you know, the sword of wisdom or something. Compassion is something kind of fluffy and, I don't know, lovely, but, you know. And I think part of the, for me, you know, the fact that Norman talks about wonder and warmth, it's that they're kind of two sides of the same thing. And that's kind of how I understand wisdom and compassion, or emptiness and compassion, that the expression, you know, what does emptiness look like? You know, what is it? What, you know, emptiness is such a kind of philosophical sounding word. What does that actually look like? What is it? It looks like compassion. You know, that's how it's expressed. That's how it's to really touch someone else's pain, the pain of another, and want to help, want to alleviate it. That is an expression of our interconnectedness, of our oneness, of our, of the truth of emptiness. So for me, wonder and warmth, they're kind of connected, you know, wonder and warmth. I don't think it's saying that it's necessarily the easy path, although, you know, because as we know, it's not even that easy to relax, you know. And this is one of the great revelations, I think, that we can come to understand with meditation, that the untrained mind, I mean, you know, this is kind of one of the propositions of the Buddha, you know, in the kind of Theravada tradition, the untrained mind, it's very difficult for a mind that's untrained to fully relax. Because why? Because we're just pulled around. Always. We're just yanked by our suffering, by our stories, by our clinging, you know. Sometimes, you know, I can't remember where I first heard this, but this idea of like a good test, or it sounds like a strong word, a good check of our own spiritual development is to see how easily we can just sit by ourselves and do nothing. You know, just sit in a room and do nothing. And see how quickly the mind leaps to life. And whether it's, you know, I think we probably know people who couldn't do that for, you know, 10 seconds. And you know, once we have a little bit of experience in meditation, you know, we start to get glimpses of, I've got a lot of suffering in my life, in my mind, and most of it is caused by me. You know, not all of it, but a lot of it. You know, and we drive ourselves crazy and we make ourselves sick, literally. So that's just to say that it's not necessarily easy to have ease and easy to have joy. But with a little bit of training and a little bit of awareness, we start to open to that. And then, you know, to see, where am I making things harder for myself? And let go of that and keep letting go. Until we can sit, maybe we can sit for an hour or for a day, you know, and just be. And that's a pretty interesting thing. It's like, I remember one, I had to take a long plane ride. I think it was for work or something years ago. And I had sort of just started studying with Gil Franzel. I don't know, this was like 15 years ago or something. And I asked Gil, how can I meditate on the airplane? And he said, well, forget about meditation. He said, just get in your seat and get comfortable. Get as comfortable as you can get. And close your eyes and just sit there. And then notice and just be content, you know, find some contentment and just notice what is it that takes you away from that contentment, you know. And it was such a great exercise. And what I noticed is anything and everything take me away. It was my own thoughts. It was the person next to me. It was the sound of the announcements. It was the smell of this or the not, you know. It was physical discomfort. It was thinking about XYZ, you know. And it was so interesting. I mean, there was nothing, you know, on paper, there was no reason not to be content. I was just sitting there. It was like, you know, no big problems. But so we can practice in a way that we find as much contentment or as ease as is available in the moment. And then really start to study what gets in the way of that? What takes me away from that? And meet that with a lot of compassion, you know. And I think little by little on this path, it doesn't mean that we don't think thoughts anymore or even painful thoughts, but we start to come into a different relationship with our thinking. That we're not so pulled around by our thoughts. We're not so quick to believe them. You know, we have a little bit of independence, a little bit of, you know, we're not so quick to just leap up and move when we have a little body pain, a little ache, we can watch it, we can study it. And I think in doing that, freedom grows and ease grows and we're able to sort of be with rather than always be doing and fixing. So anyway, Sorry, a long answer to this. Thank you.
Max, could you just repeat the line? I think it was, death is a gift to us.
Oh, yeah. You want me to say the poem again? Or just that line?
I think it's there a couple times, isn't it?
Yeah. So, death is a favor to us, but our scales have lost their balance. The impermanence of the body should give us great clarity, deepening the wonder in our senses and eyes of this mysterious existence we share and are surely just traveling through. Death is a favor to us, but our minds have lost their balance. The miraculous existence and impermanence of form always makes the awakened ones laugh and sing.
Thank you. It can be seen as a radical statement. Death is a favor to us.
Yes.
So I thought it was worth repeating.
Yeah. Thank you. And in my mind, there is this, you know, that one of the expressions of that awakened clarity, you know, the miraculous existence and impermanence of form, to have this awakened clarity, this deepened wonder, is this idea of sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, the Buddha of just this.